Welcome to the Grace in Common podcast, a conversation on Neo-Calvinism, life and theology between four friends, four theologians from four countries on three continents. My name is James Eglinton and I teach Reformed Theology at the University of Edinburgh, joined by my regular co-hosts, Marinus de Jong, pastor of the Oosterpark Kerk in Amsterdam and also of the Neo-Calvinism Research Institute in Kampen, Utrecht. Grace Utanto, native of Indonesia and professor of systematic theology at Reformed Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. And Corey Brock, originally of the United States, but now a pastor at St. Columba's Free Church in Edinburgh, Scotland, and also a lecturer at Edinburgh Theological Seminary. So this is another live recording where we're all together in the same room, and we're recording this from Grand Rapids, Michigan, where we are gathered for this year's Kuiper Conference, and we've been making the most of time here to interview scholars of Neo-Calvinism who are also here for the same conference, and we're delighted to have the chance to talk with George Haring. And George, you were the first ever guest that we had on the podcast way back in season one.
I'm proud.
Yeah, so we're honored that you're willing to return after that experience and delighted to get the chance to talk with you. So George is someone who really needs no introduction to anyone who reads around Neo-Calvinism. He is the Netherlands' leading historian of Neo-Calvinism, long-standing professor at the Free University of Amsterdam, also at the Theological University of Kampen. Now that Kampen has relocated to Utrecht, George, you're the rector of Utrecht Theological University. So delighted that we have the chance to talk with you. I think what we would like to focus the conversation on is your perspective as a Dutch scholar of Neo-Calvinism on the state of Neo-Calvinism in 2024, and particularly thinking about its place in the Netherlands, internationally. But I wanted to start off with a personal recollection of something that you said about Neo-Calvinism back in 2008, also here in Grand Rapids, that I heard and that was really pivotal in my own life and in my PhD work. So that was a conference that was here at Calvin, and it was to mark the completion of the four volumes of Bavinck's Dogmatics in English. And I was a first-year PhD student at the time, and was trying to work out what to write my thesis on. I knew it was going to be on Herman Bavinck, but I was struggling to come up with a topic that I thought really needed to be dealt with. And one of the things that surprised me when I got to this conference, and people were here from all over the American theological scene, lots of different tribes represented, and people were all trying to work out what to do with Herman Bavinck. And one of the things that surprised me was entering all of these sessions where people were talking about two different Herman Bavincks, that there was this Orthodox Bavinck and this modern Bavinck. And Bavinck, obviously, you know, I mean, this is a conversation that a lot of us have had over quite a few years now, to try and reunite a reading of Bavinck, at least outside of the Netherlands. But this was something that people were talking about. There were people arguing for very different conclusions from Bavinck's theology and apportioning some parts of his work for one cause, some parts of his work for another. And this was all just going on in the background in the conference. And it was like he was landing on a bunch of existing tensions in the American theological scene and being annexed. I remember that conference. I walked into a session that you were speaking at, and I just finished giving my own paper, and I walked in and I caught this very passionate statement that you made, challenging this American division of Bavinck, and you said, if we don't move beyond this, we will lose him as soon as we have gained him. And that was a life-changing moment for me. I'm really glad that I walked in just to catch the very end of what you had to say there. Because that then became the trajectory of my PhD thesis, and the rest in terms of what I've been working on and him is history, as they say. So there's something that's really important about having someone in that kind of context with a long Dutch pedigree of how to read this figure to help us. That was back in 2008. That was your assessment of the state of the field when we just had the Reformed Dogmatics. And you warned us not to lose him as quickly as we gained him. It's now 2024. You're back at Kelvin and another Kuiper conference. Give us your impression of the state of the field. Have we kept Herman Bavinck? And what's neo-Calvinism like internationally through your eyes all these years on?
Okay. Thank you for this
long introduction.
Nice. Thank you. 2008. Yeah, I remember these were the closing remarks to the conference, I think. Yeah. And I was a little bit afraid that now that the work had been done, the four volumes were there, there was a kind of a feeling at that conference that, okay, now we are done. We have all we need, and we rely on Bavinck, and then we can answer all questions, and we go into any theological debate with Bavinck under our arms, and we will win the debate. So I was a little bit afraid of that feeling, that atmosphere. And that's why I said, well, after Bavinck, of course, we got the 20th century, and so we have to move on. Bavinck is a very interesting resource, I think, and an important one, but it's not the end of all the questions. It's not the answer to all the questions. So, and now we are, let's say, 16 years later, and I just read the book that Gray has finished on God and Humanity, and the conclusion that I draw is that he indeed makes a next step. So what I wanted that would happen, and that I cannot do myself because I'm not a theologian, that's what theologians are doing now. Right? There is a next generation. You were working on your PhD at that time. In the meantime, you wrote a biography on Bavinck that became quite well known and is very important. So there is a next generation who is doing different things. So when I, for the first time, went to the Kuiper conference in 1998, and so the first 10 years, people were repeating in lectures about the importance of sphere sovereignty and about common grace, but you could sense they didn't really know, they had not really researched, so they repeated more or less what had been said. And in general, I think that was a weakness at Calvin College at that time. Calvin College, in general, after the Second World War, Dooie Weert and Kuiper had been repeated, re-explained, once more explained, etc. But no further steps until people like Nick Walterstorff, etc., came. And Plantinga. So they did something new, not something everyone agreed with, but they did at least something new in their tradition and faced the questions of the day. Well, and I think that is happening now in the theological field as well. And when I, for the first time, came and the first years came, it was always George explain what happened in the Netherlands at that time. And then I explained it. I gave a lecture on a certain topic. But now I know, though still the historical aspect is not well known to everyone, but now I know that there is a tradition going on of neo-Calvinism independent of what you should know about the Netherlands. So there is a new stage, I would say, a new phase in the history of neo-Calvinism. And that's, of course, what I had hoped for, and I'm very glad that this happened. So I'm very positive about the present situation, also because it's people from very different backgrounds. That was also a disadvantage in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. All those people came from the Netherlands who lived in the U.S., and so neo-Calvinism became something Dutch. Well, that problem has been overcome now, too. So people come from all different countries and also not reformed backgrounds. So various backgrounds. And I think that's very fruitful for the discussion. I think that we in the Netherlands do not realize the potential that has been discovered outside of the Netherlands of neo-Calvinism. So when we talk, Marinus can, I think, add to this, but when you talk in the Netherlands about neo-Calvinism, now the first thing people say that it is outdated. that was Kuiper, former days. We live in a different society. But the interesting thing is that many people, of course, outside of the Netherlands are interested in neo-Calvinism for theological reasons, but also for societal reasons. They see a problem in their society, and they think that neo-Calvinism might address that problem in a proper way. So that's my first impression.
I think a big change, like if we take again 2008 as some kind of benchmark year, I think Stogmatics comes out in English. A big change, I think, over those 16 years has been that attention to neo-Calvinism has not just been restricted to Herman Bavinck, you know, and then those were your closing comments as well. And 16 years on, there people internationally are talking about Klaus Schilder and the resources that are opening up, J.H. Bavinck more recently. If you're really, really a super fan, like Greg Parker is very into Konrad Bavinck. Israel Guerrero is really interested in Jan Bavinck, the father of Herman Bavinck. So, there's very specialized interest in some more peripheral figures in the tradition. But it's very much a constellation, I guess, of different contributors in history that people are aware of. How do you look on the range of figures who are represented and how we look back at the tradition now? Are there more names that we still need to bring into the conversation? How well do we need to join the dots between all of these figures?
Yeah. So these are of course important names, and it is indeed surprising that Skilder's name pops up time and again. And also, it's also interesting that J.H. Bavinck is mentioned because he is not a controversial figure like Skilder was, and therefore you don't talk about him in the Netherlands. But J.H. Bavinck was not talked about at all. It was over. And you had someone to remind of Bavinck. So I paid some attention to him in relation to the discussion on apartheid in the Netherlands. He more or less started that discussion. He went to South Africa several times in the 50s, and that was, I think, important for the discussion in the Dutch churches on apartheid. But people have totally forgotten. When they talk about apartheid, they think of Mandela or they think of Beyers Naudé, but they don't think of these figures. So Bavinck was totally forgotten. And you can think, of course, yeah, are there other interesting names? Well, if I think of Gerhardus Voss, who also was mentioned, but he is Dutch, but he's an American. then I always mentioned S.G. de Graaf with his Verbondsgeschiedenis, the history of the covenant. I think that was also quite a creative theologian. But then you come to discussions like who belongs to tradition, who not. So after the Second World War, the tradition in the Netherlands becomes more or less vague. And then you can have a discussion about someone like Berghauer. Why is he not included? Why don't we talk about him in these conferences? He wrote, I think, a dozen or 25 green volumes on all kinds of dogmatic issues, but we don't talk about him. Maybe because we think he doesn't belong to the tradition. But then you have the debate who belongs to the tradition and who does not. Marinus and I were at a conference in Wuppertal 2 or 3 weeks ago, and there was a debate, or there was a question at the beginning of the conference on European neo-Calvinism. We are talking here about neo-Calvinism, that's Abraham Kuyper, Herman Bavinck, and some others. But Karl Barth, he also had a claim on Calvin, and he also said, I want to renew the Calvinist tradition facing the present questions. Well, isn't that the same Kuiper and Bavinck did? So that question was raised at the beginning of the conference, but at the end of the conference we concluded that this was not the case. So especially the Dutch neo-Calvinists, of course, said, nein, he does not belong to the neo-Calvinist tradition. And I think partly that's true, but still, the fact that Karl Barth was ignited by Skilder, who was more or less on the same line. Marinus has explained that in an interesting article about the early Skilder. But the fact that Schilder reacted so intensely, and also Berghauer, by the way, that gives the impression that there was something akin. There was something that they liked, but did not like. So he is my nephew, but I don't like how he does. So I react to him. Otherwise, I could ignore him, but he's my nephew. So I react. So that sense is there. So Berghauer, does he belong to tradition? J.H. Bavinck, I don't know. I think you will know. Did he ever use the word neo-Calvinism?
Yeah, I'm actually not sure. That's a great question. I mean, if he doesn't use the word, he is utterly a neo-Calvinist in his thinking, in a very creative way. He's inexplicable without it.
Yeah, but it's definitely an interesting question. In that same conference in Germany, I also sat through a paper of a German scholar who was taking Arnold von Ruhler to be a neo-Calvinist. Yeah. So she was comparing him to Moltmann and taking all kinds of conclusions. And towards the end, I tried to be subtle and probably was very direct and Dutch, but I tried to suggest, well, maybe von Ruhler was not a neo-Calvinist. I think he isn't. He was not in the historical tradition, and he would definitely not consider himself one either. And also like J.H. Bavinck, so you said he was ignored. That's partly true, but in my missiological education in Kampen, Case Haag, he talked about J.H. Bavinck, and there was also ambiguity about him always from Case Haag. So the whole idea of Atlantics, was used by you know, my education. It was very important, but also there was warning and suspicion towards J.H. Bavinck. So when I first heard you guys about J.H. Bavinck, I had some red flags, right? I've barely read him, but there was like, and also intuitively it was like, does he belong to it? He was kind of like a little bit suspicious, right? So, and also your suggestion about Barth is interesting. Also at the same German conference, I think it was important we made clear that Karl Barth is not part of neo-Calvinism. But I sometimes wonder if we are another 50 years on, and we look back on the history, there may be people who will argue for more like convergence of the two traditions, because I mean, of course there are many differences, but there are also as you said, there are historical parallels. It was both like a kind of new orthodoxy, and for the example of Schilder, he often says that he only polemicized with those he considers close to him. He never polemicized with the Catholic. It was just not interesting to him. So I think he felt very clearly that Barth was someone who was indeed a brother in many ways, and therefore needed to be needed to be corrected. Yeah, for sure. So yeah.
So George, when you think about how internationally spread out neo-Calvinism is now, and the neo-Calvinist seed has been scattered and sown in lots of different soils across the world culturally, is the question of who is in and who is out harder or easier to answer in 2024?
In a way, it's easier to answer because, we have now so many angles from which this tradition is being researched. And also new questions are raised. And that opens also the possibility to say, okay, we have drawn the line somewhere, but maybe we have to extend it. So in the case of Van Ruhler, for example, it is still interesting that he wrote a book on Kuiper's notion of culture. Van Ruhler's political ideas were very well received in Vrijgemaakte circles. So because he was, of course, for a public Christian presence, and that resonated to certain very staunch Vrijgemaakte people who, of course, had problems with Kuiper for some decades because of the church split, and then found in Van Ruhler a kind of an ally. So that's there. But another difficult one is Cornelius van Til. For Cornelius van Til, more or less influenced by Schilder, of course, was very much against Karl Barth. He was very busy explaining that he was not good,
I cannot. He was a Keter or a
heretic.
Heretic. And but Van Til was also interesting because, well, of course, he does a lot with the works of Kuiper and Bavinck, but he's also in line with Dooyeweerd and Vollenhoven. And that's another interesting aspect. The philosophy of Dooyeweerd and Vollenhoven has become petrified in my years, in the 70s and in the 80s. And then someone like Professor van Woudenberg, René van Woudenberg from the Vrije Universiteit, was saved by the fact that he learned to know about Plantinga and Nick Walterstorff. That was creative. And so that, in the Netherlands, my impression is that Dooyeweerd and Vollenhoven are dead. So you have to retranslate it, as our colleague Jan van der Stoep tries. But in the United States, there is still a group that is interested. I don't know how strong it is, but I'm glad that someone like Jan van der Stoep, and not per se his person, but as a philosopher, is present at these conferences and has his contribution again. That that was not the case. It was mainly theologians who came to the conference, now some historians, but philosophers were not there. And the philosophy of Scott is part of the tradition.
Yeah, if I'm reflecting on the last 16 years and when I first started doing neo-Calvinistic studies and reflecting on what you just said, James, and everything you just said as well, George, was how much consternation I felt when I first got into Bavinck studies, with the ways in which everybody seems to disagree about what Bavinck was saying. And so therefore, you know, the amount of work that we had to do just to clear our throats before we could say something positive or, you know, constructive from Bavinck's work was quite overwhelming, seemingly, at the start of my PhD years in Edinburgh. But now I feel like the transition and, you know, what I was trying to do in God and Humanity specifically, George, which I'm really grateful for your kind words, was that now finally there's a kind of feeling of freedom. It's kind of like when you're playing a game and you're just done with the tutorial. And now here's the world in front of you. Go and roam in it. Maybe you're playing Zelda like Corey is, or I'm playing some other game. I don't know. But I've been playing a lot of the PS5 recently between 8 to 10 p.m. And I've been thinking about games a lot. So, but there's this wonderful feeling probably about 3 hours in after the introductory stuff is done, before this whole open world is before you and you can now roam in it. And so with this second book in God and Humanity, I feel like I felt that turning point where, okay, I've been interested in so many different topics like, okay, affect theory, cognitive science of religion, and I can finally just use Bavinck without feeling like I got to justify my use of Bavinck or justify my interpretation of Bavinck. And that's very freeing, and I think that's a mark of where neo-Calvinistic studies is these days. Hopefully it can continue to have this sense of freedom and agency for the researcher to just use the tradition and redeploy it and think about the constructive conversation we'd be having with different fields. And I'm curious to hear from you as well, George, like what directions would you think it would be helpful for the neo-Calvinist tradition from now on? I mean, you talked about the retranslations of Dooyeweerd just now. Are there particular directions that you would love to see happen in the next, let's say, few years or next phase of neo-Calvinistic research?
Now, in the first place, I hope that the theological constructive development will go on. That's I think, important. And that will also mean that we move away a little bit from Bavinck and from Kuiper and from Schilder and try to address the questions of our own time. in their spirit, but still different. Well, what I don't see develop very much is, of course, the political influence. And so when in the United States in the 1980s you had the issue, is America still a Christian country or is it becoming secular? So it's an either or. And then the choice of the moral majority was, of course, it is a Christian country and we should go back to that country. Yeah, we left that country, we should go back. And the secularists, of course, they felt free and said, we have to go forward. And at that moment, people like Rich Mao tried to offer a third way by saying, okay, I come from the Kuiperian tradition, and the Kuiperian tradition in the Netherlands was new in the 19th century in that sense that they took the position that the Netherlands is not a Christian country, but a country with Christians in it, among others, and that we have to contribute to the public domain
as Christians. And that means making room for the other opinions as well. That's very important. There is freedom of conscience, and we have to we have to realize that and make that a political practice. And I think that worked out for several decades in the Netherlands very well. But I don't see this come to fruition in another country. And maybe the same issue of the Christian school. They tried in the CSC circles, of course, to found Christian schools, and that happened, but it's typical a CRC thing. And so it did not expand, in my opinion. And then my question is, does that have to do with the with the typicalities of the Dutch situation, or, well, what is the reason? Why doesn't neo-Calvinism develop in other domains than theology at the moment? I don't know. And that's what I would like to see that happens. And we all recognize, Dutch or not Dutch, when you go back to the sources and you say, well, these are very interesting debates and interesting solutions, but maybe they fit it only in the 19th century context and not so much in the 20th or 21st century. So we, in the anti-revolutionary party after the Second World War, there was already the idea, the whole notion of sphere sovereignty, of pluralism, those are empty boxes, as was said. It didn't resonate anymore in the political practice.
Yeah, so even in the French context, I recently dug a little bit into a French export of neo-Calvinism in the first half of the 20th century. And there, I mean, it's a very similar conclusion. I mean, the name of this guy, Auguste de Serf, he takes a lot of the philosophical and theological insights and translate that into French context. But when it comes to politics, he doesn't. Even though I would say that in the French context, there's a lot of potential for it. I mean, they have a context of laïcité, they have a context of pluriformity. There's a lot of, the political system would allow for something like Kuiper has into it. And the same would go for the United States, maybe. The two-party system is, of course, makes it complicated. But it has all, one would say, all the groundwork ready to apply it. But it didn't happen. But he also didn't do it, right? In terms of Le Cerf, he didn't even try, right? So that's, yeah.
Someone like Karel Barth, of course, thought about that solution, and the Barthians in the Netherlands did think about it, and they didn't want to do it. And so they said, well, you cannot claim the Christian character of your school. And that's hubris.
Yeah. That's Barth, yeah.
Yeah. So, so that's one of the reasons why I think that neo-Calvinism doesn't resonate very much in Germany, because the Protestant, and especially the Reformed section of the Protestantism in Germany, is very much influenced by the ideas of Karl Barth.
So what you said earlier about hoping for more construction going forward, I mean, one of the fundamental ideas in neo-Calvinism is that we seek not repristination, but reformation, and therefore construction, and so that it ought not ever look the same, right? And so, I mean, in the light of that, I guess, just to bring back to what you mentioned earlier, George, what are some of the ways you think about defining, or how you go about, what theological principles or other principles beyond theology do you use to include that circle of who is a neo-Calvinist? I mean, what are those things for you in your mind? I mean, we talk in the handbook about the river and the tributaries and the streams that flow off the tributaries that get smaller and smaller and are farther away maybe, but still part of the river to some degree. You know, what is it that qualifies one as a tributary or stream in your mind?
Well, that's not easy to define, I think. But so in the case of the Netherlands, for example, there is still a contribution from the Christian political parties that are around, though they do not refer to Kuiper anymore, but they work more or less with their view, his view of society. Well, I think, as I said before, that I am wondering, why doesn't this happen in other countries? It happened in the Netherlands, but at the same time, I realize we are now in the Netherlands in a situation that we should also develop political presence and educational presence, etc. And we see how difficult it is. It's a hard time. So maybe it's just the constitution of the 19th century situation that made this possible. Huh? So in my article on the handbook, I stress very much that the liberal context, in a way, was very helpful to the anti-revolutionaries, and that they got strong support for the Catholics, who were way stronger in their political presence than the anti-revolutionary party was. So specific conditions helped to promote the anti-revolutionary party, and that conditions may not be present in the United States. Eh? So Rich Mao thought they were present in the 1980s, 1990s, but I guess he will also be disappointed now in the possibilities for neo-Calvinism in the American political scene. Even if you have the choice between the Republicans and the Democrats, I think the Democrats, from an anti-revolutionary point of view or a Christian point of view, are not very satisfying at the moment, and the Republicans are not either.
I wonder if you could reflect on the change of two locations that were really important for neo-Calvinism in different ways in recent years. So you have a lot of personal history in both places. So Princeton, you mentioned already that you first went to the Kuiper Conference in Princeton, where it used to be before it came here to Grand Rapids, and was it 19? You from the 1990s onwards, but now that chapter of the history of neo-Calvinism, which was significant internationally because that was where we converged, it was where a lot of us met for the first time. That chapter is closed, and it's now moved here. But the other location is Kampen, in the Netherlands, where neo-Calvinism had a very long history, since you were last on the podcast, that chapter has closed and a new chapter has opened, and you're now in Utrecht.
Mm.
Could you share your thoughts on what those two changes of locations means for neo-Calvinism today?
Yeah. So, and you might also mention the Vrije Universiteit. Hey?
Yeah.
There are articles.
Of course, yeah.
Princeton and Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Princeton. Okay. But first Princeton. Now, Princeton, of course, was the place where neo-Calvinism landed, thanks to the Stone Lectures by Kuiper in 98, and then in 1908, Bavinck, and then in 1918, it was Henry Dosker, who was the friend of Herman Bavinck, and in the 1920s, they tried to get H.H. Kuiper. He didn't come, but in 1930, that's the son of Abraham Kuiper, and in 1930, the successor of Bavinck, Valentine Hepp, came and gave the Stone Lecture. So this was an era in which neo-Calvinism was really present, thanks to people like B.B. Warfield and Gerhardus Voss, of course. And then Barth came in, and Princeton moved over to Karl Barth. And when I met Max Steckhouse in 1998, he explained to me that he wanted this Kuiper conference in Princeton. Max Steckhouse was the ethicist at Princeton Seminary. And he said, well, He had learned to know Kuiper. He had in his student days, he had been in the Netherlands, and he had learned to know Kuiper, and he had learned to appreciate him. So he always said to his students, and I was in his classroom several times, I also taught in his classroom, but he always said to his students every year again, if you want to praise God, read Karl Barth. If you want to do something in society, read Abraham Kuiper. And that was always his buzzword. which he used. Well, that was very successful. Max was a big name in Princeton, and he got something done. The faculty was not in favor, but he convinced them, or he pressed them, and it happened. And then there was the money of Raymond de Vries, of course, who invested in this project. And we bought a large library of neo-Calvinist books was bought. There was a Kuiper Center. There were grants. So that worked perfectly. And it helped that Princeton is a very international name. So it attracted always a lot of people. Those were very nice conferences. But of course, then the Kuiper Prize, also financed by Raymond de Vries, was given to Tim Keller in 17, I think it was. And then, of course, the Liberal Presbyterian Church said that's not possible because he serves a church where they don't ordain women. Well, and then the president gave in, and then I was in a discussion about staying or leaving, and I said, well, if this is the case, leave. So, and then we decided to leave, and well, we ended up in Grand Rapids, which we did not prefer, I have to say, but that was the best location at that time. You might now think of another location like the Reformed Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C., but we chose for Grand Rapids, and that worked out very well. So they facilitate us, that's not the problem. But Princeton got lost, and there is no Kuiper presence, as a matter of fact, in Princeton anymore at the moment. And that was disappointing, because I had the idea that, okay, something went wrong in 1930. They chose for Cora Bart and excluded the neo-Calvinists. Now they could... they could change and forget about that mistake and invite neo-Calvinism in again, next to Barthianism, which was also very present still in Princeton. But that, in the end, that didn't work. It worked for 20 years, but then it was over. and well, in the Netherlands, you could say it's not that dramatic, because 2017, in my opinion, was dramatic. It's not that dramatic in the Netherlands, but the Vrije Universiteit was, of course, the location of neo-Calvinism. Kuiper taught there, Bavink taught there, J.H. Bavink taught there. so this was the place, and the archives were there of Kuiper and Bavink. But, yeah, the Vrije Universiteit is being secularized, and they are not that interested in the neo-Calvinist tradition anymore, or only... in a very secular translation of we are open to any opinion or whatever. So very general things that do not really relate to Kuiper or Bavink. So it's still there. And that was for me a reason in 2018 to move to Kampen. And they replaced me by Joost Hengsmengel, who is in the Department of Theology and teaches and researches neo-Calvinism. But he is more or less on his own. And when I came to Kampen, they asked me to found a neo-Calvinism institute. Well, we did, and that moved to Utrecht. And, well, in my opinion, this is the center of neo-Calvinism in the Netherlands now. And so not everyone in my university agrees with that, but when you talk to them for an hour, they will agree that, well, we come from the neo-Calvinist tradition, and they have sometimes somewhat complicated relationship with that tradition, but they belong to that tradition. And we were just visited, we had a visitation committee, and I talked with the visitation committee. These are professors from other universities who, let's say, talk about your research program. And they said to me, why don't you make the NRI the institution of the university? Because you are all neo-Calvinists. That's what they said from the outside. I don't think that will be very wise to do, but it says something that if they recognize the Theological University of Utrecht, they recognize neo-Calvinism. So that's your brand, sell it. So that's that's what I think, and I think it's vital at Utrecht University, our theological university. So I think we have a lot of possibilities for the future, but we have to do that, and we have to realize that we have to do that in an international context. Otherwise, it would not function.
Just to add to it, I think for our Dutch context, it would really... What we still need, I think, is show, don't tell for more time in order for it to like work. So that's our job for the coming time to do that. Yeah. To just show why, don't mention Kuiper as much or Bavink or the word neo-Calvinism or the word gereformeerd, because we still struggle with that heritage too much. It was just in a previous episode where we talked to Jim Brett, we also talked about that, that about the reception of the biographies by James of Bavinck and also by his biography of Kuiper in the Netherlands. There were like positive reactions, but also mixed reactions, because for some reason, we're still not really able, I say we, but I don't include myself in that we, apparently we're still unable to deal with that tradition and accept that some people just like it and are positive about it. Apparently we still need to, more time to just don't talk about it explicitly, but show why we think it's valuable and also tell them why other people think it is.
Yeah, so that's a discussion about strategy. Eh? So if you mention the names of Kuiper and Bavinck and Neo-Calvinism, quite different from the United States, but if you mention the name in the Netherlands, you always get a negative reaction. And we tend to react to that, and we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't do that. No, we should just ignore that and do our job. I agree.
George, thank you for coming back on Grace and Common. Maybe in 16 years we'll do another retrospective. Who knows, for Neo-Calvinism will be then, we'll have taken over the world and transformed it and confirmed all the stereotypes. And thank you again, George, for coming and sharing your thoughts with us. Thank you to listeners for joining us again for another episode. If you've enjoyed the episode, please subscribe if you don't, with whichever podcast app you use. We're always really happy to hear from listeners with feedback, with thoughts, with suggestions for future episodes. You can reach out to us on social media. You can also email us. The details for that are in the show notes. If you'd like to support our podcast financially, we do also have a donor box, and the link to that is also in the show notes. For now, though, thank you again for listening. This is Grace in Common.